In the winter of 2010, there was a robbery in Detroit. Not a robbery at a bank or a jewelry store. No, these thieves robbed a Radio Shack on Jefferson Avenue.
Two guys rush in holding a .38. They've got plaid laundry bags. They order the workers at gunpoint into the back room, and they force them to fill up the laundry bags with brand new smartphones.
5 days later, the same guys take down a T-Mobile store on 7 Mile Road. 3 months later, they drive 3.5 hours to Warren, Ohio, to rob a Radio Shack there. And then another Radio Shack in Highland Park, and on and on.
But only cell phones. And this is 2010, so you got to think the Apple 4S,
oh, yeah,
the Galaxy 3, and the, remember the T-Mobile MyTouches?
I think so, but I think they still make them. Eventually, the cops get a break in the case, and they arrest a guy named Michael Green, a 30-year-old who held down jobs at Wendy's, White Castle's, the ballpark, but eventually found stealing more lucrative.
So the cops arrest Michael Green, and immediately he flips. He starts naming names of the other guys in his crew. They all have nicknames.
There's Nitty, Gangster Crippy, and then there are all the Tims, Big Tim, Little Tim, Baby Tim, who also goes by Tim Tim.
So many Tims. But the police have a real problem because all they have is Michael Green's confession, this one guy, and for all the cops know, he could be lying to them.
But Green does give them something else, too. Cell phone numbers, including the phone number of Little Tim, whose real name is Timothy Carpenter. And Green tells the cops this guy, Little Tim, he is one of the ringleaders. And that number, that one cell phone number, that is what does Timothy Carpenter in. Little Tim's cell phone gives the FBI a way to know where he has been nearly every minute of every day for months and months.
And that is how a guy accused of going on a cell phone robbery spree ends up being screwed by his own cell phone.
Hello and welcome to Planet Money. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Noelle King.
Our cell phones may feel like these private, personal possessions to us, but they are giving away information about us all the time. With every call, every text, every time we email or stream a video, that phone is pinging off some cell tower, and the cell phone company is recording where we are. Those records get stored for a long time, and it turns out it's pretty easy for the government to get a hold of them.
Today on the show, a small-time criminal case gets kicked up to the Supreme Court, and this case could decide how much privacy we can expect for all the footprints we leave behind in the digital world.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from State Farm, who knows that many Americans struggle with their finances and most have never been taught how to manage them. Starting today, State Farm wants to change that by giving people the tools, help, and education they need to take control of their money, putting financial well-being within the reach of everyone. You can find out more at letstarttoday.com. State Farm, here to help life go right.
It is pretty easy for the police to find out where your cell phone has been. The biggest cell phone companies have cops contacting them all the time, trying to get the records of people who they think committed crimes.
The cops don't even need a warrant. They just need to show up in front of a judge and say, hey, we think maybe this guy might have committed a crime.
Which is exactly what the police did in the case of Little Tim Carpenter. So Carpenter gets a lawyer, and he's really lucky. He lands one of the top criminal defense lawyers in Detroit, a guy named Harold Gurewitz. Now, Harold takes a lot of high-profile cases, but he also gets appointed to represent defendants who can't afford a lawyer. And that is how he ended up with Little Tim Carpenter as a client.
Now, a case about a string of Radio Shack robberies, that's kind of small potatoes for a guy like Harold Gurewitz. In 40 years as a defense lawyer, he has represented mob bosses and drug kingpins and former Detroit mayors. He knows all about wires and jailhouse informants and undercover cops.
But that's kind of all old school. What Harold wasn't expecting was the FBI coming to him and saying, yo, we have your client's cell phone location records.
I was really overwhelmed is an appropriate word, because I hadn't dealt with it before, quite frankly.
In any of your cases?
In any of my cases.
Metro PCS, which is Little Tim's cell phone carrier, hands over 127 days of Tim's cell phone data to the FBI. Now, this is 200 pages of spreadsheets showing everywhere that Little Tim's cell phone has been at the beginning and at the end of every call for 4 months.
Cell towers, location data, longitude and latitude. I'm not sure that I was able to make any clear sense of it because there was just too much. It was too difficult to find my way through it.
But it was nothing for the FBI because the feds have these computer programs that take those 127 days of data and turn it all into a map. A map that shows where was Tim Carpenter and when. And as you can imagine, it turns out that Radio Shack robbery on Jefferson Avenue,
Little Tim is nearby.
Yep. The T-Mobile store robbery on 7 Mile Road,
Little Tim, again, right nearby.
You got it. The Radio Shack heist in Warren, Ohio,
Little Tim was in the area.
Uh-huh. And the Radio Shack holdup in Highland Park, surprise, surprise, Tim Carpenter is there.
This is not looking good for Little Tim.
Uh-uh. And while his lawyer, Harold Gurewitz, is trying to figure out what to do with all this cell phone data, more of Little Tim's friends are talking. And this is their story. Little Tim was one of the guys in charge. He was never one of the guys inside the store with the guns. He was usually waiting outside in a stolen car. And later, he'd run the bags of these stolen cell phones down to a fence and get $10,000 or $20,000 in exchange. Now, normally, Harold Gurewitz, his lawyer, could cast doubt on all this testimony because these guys have all these reasons to lie. But Tim Carpenter's cell phone data backs all these stories up.
Do you think this is the evidence that got Timothy Carpenter convicted ultimately?
I do. The answer is yes. It's the kind of evidence that, in the end, is the most difficult to argue to a jury that they shouldn't credit because the records are what they are. And they're presented with the blessing of an FBI agent who says, I'm an expert, and this is what I think they mean.
All right, so Harold loses the case, and his client, Little Tim, gets sentenced to 116 years in prison.
Damn.
Yeah, 116 years because he was convicted on several counts, and the sentences couldn't run concurrently. So the time added up.
And it might have ended there, but it didn't. In fact, this is where things start to look a little brighter for Tim Carpenter, because this case isn't just about a man knocking over some Radio Shacks.
No, this is about privacy. And it's about our expectations of privacy. Should our cell phones, yours and mine, be permitted to operate as little pocket-sized tracking devices on all of us?
And you know who's really into privacy, Noelle? You know who's been looking for the perfect test case that could go all the way up to the Supreme Court? Take a guess, any guess.
I am going to guess the ACLU.
Bingo! At this point, the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, has been watching a bunch of cell phone location data cases across the country. None of them have made it to the Supreme Court yet. But for whatever reason, the 9 justices decide to hear the cell phone data case starring the cell phone robber.
The man at the ACLU who has made cell phone privacy his life's obsession is a lawyer named Nate Wessler. Nate Wessler swoops onto the Carpenter case to help Harold Gurewitz out. Nate is not confounded by all the data. In fact, this is his sweet spot. This is what he does. Although, he says he does reserve the right to be confused by some of Little Tim's behavior.
On one day, he made 141 calls, made or received 141 calls.
Wait, one day he had 141 calls?
That's right. He was on his phone a lot. Not every day was that many by any means. I have no idea why he was on the phone that much that day.
The point is, Tim Carpenter did not do himself any favors by being on his phone so much.
When you start putting the data together, certainly a day's worth, a week's worth, a month's worth, in this case, more than 4 months' worth, you easily paint a very detailed picture of someone's comings and goings over time, their patterns of life, you know, where they sleep, where they go during the day, who else they're associating with. So it starts to really chart quite a detailed and rich picture of a person's life.
And this is where Nate Wessler, the lawyer, starts his argument. He says the cops don't just have cell phone data that ties Little Tim to crimes. They also have cell phone records that involve a lot of his personal business.
And they argue Tim's personal business should be protected from government intrusion the way your home is protected from government intrusion. I mean, if police thought you committed a crime and wanted to break into your apartment, they would need a warrant to do that. With cell phone location data, they don't need a warrant. And Nate's argument is they should get a warrant for that kind of information because it can reveal really personal, intimate details about someone's life, details that the government should not have ready access to.
So to prove this point, he goes digging through Tim Carpenter's cell phone data. What did the feds have on him, and was any of it personal? He decides to map it out. The problem is that the feds, while fine with turning over the data, were not going to make things easy for the opposition.
When the government turned over these records to Mr. Carpenter's defense attorney as part of the pretrial discovery process, they just gave them a PDF, not an Excel spreadsheet, which meant that when we got them from the defense attorney, we had to have our team painstakingly enter those numbers into an Excel spreadsheet.
Oh, my God.
Truly maddening.
I feel sorry for your interns.
It was a long process. They were so diligent and so patient.
Okay, so while these poor interns are sifting through 7,000 lines of mind-numbing data, they do start to put a picture together of Tim Carpenter's life. They actually learn two things about him. The first, you probably would never guess, Noelle. Apparently, Tim Carpenter was a churchgoer.
I guess he missed the sermon about not stealing cell phones from Radio Shack.
Maybe he missed that one, but he apparently went to church on many Sundays. And they learned another little nugget about him. On one night, Tim Carpenter slept somewhere other than his home.
That is Tim's business. That is Tim's business, Elsa.
But now we're getting into it, and that is the point. Nate Wessler says this is personal, and that is why the government shouldn't have a right to get this information so easily.
Timothy Carpenter's life on a day-to-day basis was pretty boring in the way that all of our lives are pretty boring on a day-to-day basis. We get up in the morning, we have breakfast, we might see a friend or go to work or meet up with a family member. We all have routines. The point to us here, none of us in our daily lives, as boring or interesting as they might happen to be, expect that there's a little government agent sitting in our pocket with a notepad writing down a record of everywhere we've come and gone over the course of that day and that week and that month.
And that's a very scary thought you just painted.
And that's, I mean, that's
little
really...
little Smurf government agent. Okay.
That's right. And that is in some way what our cell phones have become and have allowed.
I love that Smurf government agent was the thing that popped in your head.
Smurfs can be scary, Noelle. And that's what Tim Carpenter's lawyers are arguing. They are saying your cell phone can turn into a government agent almost anytime the government likes. A government agent who can take a time machine and travel back to the past to monitor your movements 24 hours a day. An agent who never sleeps, never gets bored, never needs a lunch break, and never, ever, ever forgets a single moment. And they're saying that should scare the hell out of us.
That's the stuff of dystopian fiction. That's the stuff of 1984. That kind of pervasive, all-powerful government investigative power is really just what the framers of the Constitution were concerned about. They were well familiar with the English king's forces knocking down every door in a neighborhood looking for one particular suspect, these overbroad searches. And they created the Fourth Amendment specifically to restrain government investigative power.
The Fourth Amendment is the one that says you have a right against unreasonable searches and seizures. And the Carpenter case is all about how you interpret the Fourth Amendment in the age of cell phones.
And because the Fourth Amendment is such a major part of the legal argument here, I called this guy.
I'm a Fourth Amendment nerd, is that what I could say? Yeah, I'm a Fourth Amendment scholar, criminal procedure professor. I write a lot about the Fourth Amendment.
That's Orrin Kerr at George Washington University. And I met up with him because I wanted to talk to someone on the government side. And nobody who was actually in the government would talk to me about this case. So I turned to Orrin because he filed a brief supporting the government side.
And look, Orrin doesn't usually side with the government, but in this case, he thinks all this talk about 1984 and a dystopian future is actually just people being paranoid and a little bit ridiculous. Here's how the argument sounds to him.
Why are you not disturbed by this disturbing practice? How can you allow the government? So why do you love Big Brother?
The way Orrin sees it, and this is the big picture argument against Tim Carpenter, is that cell site location records, basically just simulate what's publicly observable in the physical world anyway.
Stuff you can see in front of your own eyes.
Exactly. And just like I can't expect to have privacy from, say, a neighbor who snoops on me from her kitchen window, I shouldn't expect that no one can watch me when I'm walking around outside while carrying my cell phone.
The fact that somebody left their house, walked out into the world, that there's a certain amount of information that's not traditionally protected under the Fourth Amendment.
And that would be it. Someone could easily watch you leave your house and watch you go to work. And it's not like there's a Fourth Amendment intrusion if that person were to report to the police that he saw you leave your house and go to work.
Right.
All right. So cell phone location is data that reveals nothing more than what an eyewitness, like a snoopy neighbor or one of the ladies from church, could have seen anyway in public. That is argument number one for the government.
And there's a second argument here, and it has to do with consent, with something that you and me and everybody else out there are consenting to every single day.
That's right. There is information that we voluntarily give up to a third party so we can communicate with people.
Yeah, when I write a letter and I put an address on the envelope or I dial a cell phone number, I am sharing that information with a third party, with the postman or with the phone company, because I want to be able to communicate. So that address, that phone number, that's not private anymore.
And with cell phone location data, there's a similar argument. Your phone needs to ping against a cell tower in order for it to work. And the argument is the phone company has a right to keep a record of all those pings and do whatever it wants with those records. But if you don't want the government to get its hands on your cell phone location records, there is an option for you. You can just turn off your phone forever. Is that feasible? I mean, is that how we should live, to carry cell phones turned off most of the time if we want to protect the privacy of our movements?
Yeah, I think it's a lot like the physical world. Imagine you decided you didn't want people to be watching you out in public. What would your options be? I mean, you have pretty limited options, right? Your option would be to not go outside, which is a really bad option.
Yes. Confining yourself to your home does not sound like a very good option.
No.
But then at the same time, we don't say, okay, well, since you don't want to be stuck in your home, you should be able to walk outside and be entitled to all the privacy you want. You can't tell people when you're walking down the street, no, don't look at me.
Believe me, I've wanted to, but I can't. But when we're talking about the digital world, what counts as walking outside? I mean, think about it. Think about all the footprints we leave behind when we use technology, when we use the internet. How many of those footprints should be private? How easy should it be for the government to see any of those footprints? These are all questions the Supreme Court might touch upon at oral argument for this case at the end of this month.
And part of the reason that little Tim Carpenter's case got kicked all the way up to the Supreme Court is that it's not just about our smartphones. Everything is smart these days.
Yeah.
There are smart fridges that know how much bacon we eat. There's those smartwatches that collect data on how fast our heart is beating.
And Tim Carpenter's lawyer, Nate Wessler, thought of another one that hadn't occurred to me.
Internet-connected vibrators, incredibly, that upload to a company's servers information about someone's sexual activity.
That's next level.
Yeah. So, Noelle, you know that I started my career as a lawyer.
Yeah.
And this is what I love about the law. You start with this tiny criminal case in Detroit, a bunch of robbers hauling away cell phones in laundry bags, taking down a bunch of Radio Shacks. And it sounds like kind of a nothing case at first, but now it's gone all the way to the Supreme Court. And it has implications for every single one of us.
Since you are a lawyer, there's a question about this that's been driving me nuts since the beginning.
Yeah.
Let's say that the Supreme Court rules in favor of Timothy Carpenter. Does he get out of jail? Does he then get to ditch the 116-year sentence?
Well, it's not likely, because of another small part of Fourth Amendment law called the good faith exception, which goes like this. If the police followed the rules when they got evidence to convict you of a crime, and then those rules change after your conviction, unfortunately for you, your conviction still stands. So while the world has this fascinating conversation about the future of privacy rules, little Tim Carpenter is probably stuck in prison for the rest of his life.
Support for Planet Money and the following message come from LinkedIn. Using skills, experiences, and more to match and promote your job to the right candidates. To find out how to receive a $50 credit toward your first job post, visit linkedin.com/money.
We love to hear from you, what you think of the show, what you want us to cover. So send us an email. We're at planetmoney@npr.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter.
Today's episode was produced by the great Sally Helm.
Woo!
Brian Erstad is our editor. Alex Goldmark is our supervising producer.
And special thanks to Paul Ohm at Georgetown Law and Andrew Crocker at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Thank you guys for educating me about the Fourth Amendment. And thank you to Tulsa Johnson and her lawyer, Matt Brummond, for talking to me about how cell phone location data affected her case.
If you're looking for something else to listen to, can I recommend Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me? It's a news quiz show. It's funny. It's irreverent. It tells it like it is. Listen to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Noelle King.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Thanks for listening. All right. So, Noelle, you once had a cell phone number that was clearly inherited from someone else. And you would get calls all the time for some woman named Rachel, right?
Yeah, I'd get them like once or twice a month. And I got a little bit obsessed. I'm like, who is Rachel? And why did she leave her phone number? And closest I got, I think Rachel owed some people some money.
Oh. So we got a little curious. Who has Tim Carpenter's phone number now? Is he the Rachel in someone else's life? His phone number's in the public record because of the case. So I gave it a call. Darn.
Oh, bummer.
Yeah. I guess maybe when you get sent to prison for armed robbery, the cell phone company retires your phone number.